What is the key insight?
Hexapodia is the key insight. 6 feet.
And what is that supposed to mean?
That there is often some key nugget of fact that if you understand it correctly and place it in its proper context, will transform your view of the situation, allowing you to grok it completely.
And in the context of Werner Vinge's amazing mind-bending science fiction space opera novel, A Fire Upon the Deep?
The importance of hexapodia is
that those sapient bushes riding around on six-wheeled scooters have been
genetically programmed to be a fifth column of spies and agents for the great evil.
Today, however, here we seek different key insights than hexapodia.
And Brad, what do you think they are?
I think they are. We have somewhat of a disagreement about Acemoglu and Johnson's book Power and Progress, which I thought was a largely useful attempt to whimper and beg that not all technological research and development, especially around labor technologies that might well substitute for labor, be put in the merciless hands of the venture capitalists and the tech oligarchs and oligarchies, and that you reacted to somewhat more negatively.
I did. I like
Simon
Simon
Johnson. Wrote a 7,000-word review of it.
I did. I wrote
of which
a
only maybe
very...
500 words are complimentary.
I'm not. Yes, I thoroughly dislike this book, which is, you know, and I should say that I do like Simon Johnson a lot. He's a friend of mine, and
yes,
I've liked every other one of his books quite a lot. You know, not like just like, oh, that's a nice book, but like, this is great. I need to give this to my friends. 13 Bankers, Jumpstarting America, really excellent books, which you should run right out and buy. Acemoglu, I often have disagreements with his papers, but he writes so many of them that I don't have time to have disagreements with them all. And
and
I
you
think
agree
that,
with a great many of the papers as well.
Yeah,
But certainly we all agree with many more of Derone's papers than of the papers than of the papers of almost anyone else. That is, given the sheer volume, even a moderate number of agreement produces an overwhelming number of papers we think are great and should be sent out to and read by other people.
I guess, right.
Yeah.
I can't say that because I'm not able to keep up with the volume.
Ah,
You know, I don't
okay.
like, I can't, he can write papers faster than I can read papers.
Yes,
So,
yes, yes.
But certainly I did like, in terms of popular writing stuff, I did like, Why Nations Fail. I
Yes.
liked it a lot. I don't think it's the kind of thing that we can ever get really definitive empirical support on, because economic history is very, very hard.
Right.
It only happens once and we don't have great data.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it was a really useful, important, good concept. And there's a lot of support for a lot of its sort of micro claims. But, you know, I think that he's been on this kick about AI since, you know, 2016, 2017. And I really think, I think that his first attempt to do this, the empirical paper with Restrepo, where they said, look, companies that use more robots hire fewer people.
Yep.
That failed, because then you had a whole bunch of other people run out to do more
Yes.
careful versions of that with better data sets, sometimes
Yes.
with instrumental variables, et cetera,
Yes.
all these other things.
I remember Larry Michel and the Economic Policy Institute people, people who are likely to be frightened of capital as a substitute for labor much more than anyone else would. That they came out
Right.
in favor of saying, well, this particular technology, set of technologies, does not really look like substitutes for, but more like complements to labor.
And so that was, you know, and then all the other papers found exactly the opposite. They found that companies that use more robots hire more people, industries that use more robots hire more people.
Right.
And it's not possible to tell at the level of countries because our sample is too small and heterogeneous, but certainly Germany, Singapore, Korea, et cetera, these are not countries where you think about like deindustrialization and loss of manufacturing jobs. These are countries you think, you know, and China has been just roboting up. And you know, China actually has been losing some manufacturing workers, but the other country, you know, Germany.
Oh, but it simply had so many.
It had too many to begin with. That's right.
Yes.
It's developing countries. It's not really comparable. If you're looking at rich countries, Singapore, Korea, and Germany, and I think Switzerland. Netherlands, maybe. These are countries with lots and lots of robots, and
So
they're not
basically, if you're
doing
making
badly.
something for which there's elastic demand, you really shouldn't bet that technological development is going to lead to job loss. Simply because the world market is so good and manufacturing exports are so, so cheap that anything that makes your manufacturing sector more efficient is almost surely going to channel, going to push more jobs into manufacturing and quite plausibly also create more engineers who will then help create a more efficient manufacturing sector and hence more jobs. You know, that at the world level, you can argue that, you can maybe argue that some forms of technological progress are not so great if they lead to people losing some of the few jobs in which blue collar workers have bargaining power, simply because the elasticity of demand for manufacturers at the world level is relatively low.
Right.
But even there, I haven't seen much sign that demand for manufactured things at the world level is relatively low. At least not when I look at the unbelievable amount of manufactured things I am surrounded by in this house. It has definitely not been the case that the fact that our manufactured things are much, much cheaper means that we spend a smaller share of our income on them. I mean, good God. I have a $1,500 computer monitor in this room that I haven't plugged in a month and a half. Largely because I've been feeling lazy and my back has hurt, that's true. And so it's been off in a corner while I've been sitting on the couch working on the laptop and kind of lying back with a cushion against my back. But even so, it would have been unbelievable to have had so much, right?
Who knows what we'll have tomorrow? But
yeah,
let's get on to power and progress. So just to sum up, I think the central argument of this book is that there's a menu of technologies that people can invent. They can choose to invent technologies that replace humans, or they can choose to invent technologies that complement humans.
Right.
And the former is bad for your average worker, even though it may help someone make some profit. And the second is good for your average worker and also helps people make some profit. And so we need to use some sort of institutions of society to nudge entrepreneurs and technologists toward creating the human complementing kinds of technology and away from creating the human replacing kinds of technology. And that's their central contention. And I think that the idea that technology, that some kinds of technology are good, that technology is sometimes good and sometimes bad for society, I think is almost a truism. I wouldn't, even without referencing replacement of human labor, I think we can obviously look at war, environmental destruction, and things like that. Even phones causing depression. I'm a fan of that explanation. So phones
causing depression?
Yeah.
As in personal depression or economic depression?
No, personal depression.
Because?
Oh, because of social isolation. There's a network effect of social hangout.
Smartphones.
No one's hanging out.
Okay. Smartphones causing depression.
No, not landlines. Come on.
I'm sorry. But,
all right, boomer.
When you
all
say
right.
Phone, I think landline.
Oh man. Okay. So
I don't know. What do I think a phone is? I don't think of smartphones as phones. I think of them as microcomputers.
You mean like the giant room-sized things of the 1970s?
No. Right.
Those are mini computers.
Looking the state-of-the-art computer in 1953, which was the IBM 701 Defense Calculator. At lunch while I should have been paying attention to the seminar. Did you know that the IBM 701 Defense Calculator, that it actually could access its memory in 12 microseconds?
I did not know that. You know what? Today I learned a thing.
Okay. And did you know that it actually had a 2,000 vacuum tubes in its central processing unit?
I did not know that either.
And that it could do 17,000 operations per second?
Let's get back to power and progress.
Okay.
All right. So
the point of it was that NVIDIA's latest N100 can do 1,000 trillion floating point operations per second, each floating point operation of which is maybe 50 times as much as a fixed point operation done by the IBM 701. And, you know, the difference between 17,000 and 1,000 trillion, the difference between 17,000 and 1,000 trillion is a factor of 60 billion. Right?
60
that
billion.
one NVIDIA H100 chip is the equivalent of 60 billion IBM 701s and its capability to do computation. And do you know how many IBM 701s they built in the 1950s?
I don't.
19.
Well, given all of this improvement, why does Zoom keep crashing? Anyway, all right.
Yes.
All right.
So in any event, we've had...
Let's get back to Power and Progress. I want to talk about this book.
We've had so much overwhelming progress in information technology that if it were job-destroying, wouldn't it have been job-destroying by now?
Well, they argue that it was. They say that... They say that inequality during the 1980 through 2020 was a lot of that inequality, they argue 80% or more of that inequality was due to information technology replacing the need for human labor and lowering demand for the labor of regular people. Acemoglu has a paper in which he claims to prove this. I have major issues with the methodology of this paper, but I spent a lot of time reading it and thinking about the methodologies, which is one reason this book review took me so long.
Uh-huh.
But yes, so they claim that 80% of inequality, of the run-up in inequality since like 1980, more or less, has been caused by information technology replacing human labor.
Okay.
I don't really believe that. Especially because when they look at history and they try to give examples of technologies that created new jobs, new things for humans to do instead of replacing humans at their old tasks, one of the main things they talk about was the telegraph. Yes. Telegraph created all these new things you could do. It allowed you to buy and sell grain from this country to that country. It allowed, even beyond like just telegraph operators, it created a whole bunch of things you could do because suddenly you could communicate much more easily. So that created this horizontal proliferation of types of work, new tasks to be done. And so they say the telegraph was a great success. Now tell me why the telegraph was a great success. How could you know, even if this is right, which I don't think it is, I think this is an obvious just, sort of brain fart where you just sort of, I think what they did was they said, okay, wages were rising during when the telegraph was invented. And right afterwards. So the telegraph must have been one of these task creating technologies, whereas, wages, like inequality rose and wages sort of stagnated after the internet was invented. So the internet must have been one of these labor replacing technologies. And I think they just sort of backfill from there. They assume the conclusion and say, okay, well, which technologies replace, but because we know the model is right, we know that if wages stagnate and inequality goes up, it must have been because technology was invented that replaced people. But if wages go up and there's, a whole bunch of plentiful jobs and like blah, 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 then it must have been because whatever innovations we can find that were created right around that time happened to be the kind of things that complemented labor, that created new tasks for people to do. And so it leads you to these ridiculous conclusions like the telegraph was labor complementing while the internet was labor substituting.
I'm still stuck because I thought the internet was labor in Shanghai complementing to an absolutely massive degree.
Well, I thought so too.
That the global value chain economy is in many ways the creation of the internet and other things to actually allow what Richard Baldwin calls the second unbundling of the location of production from the location of design and manufacturing. Right. And that this is a very powerful complement to the labor of everyone wanting to work in manufacturing who doesn't happen to be located in a major first world city.
Yes, and global inequality went down as a result of, among other things, supply chaining.
Okay, so that Acemoglu and company are taking a rather narrow nationalist perspective here.
They do then.
Yes.
Although, in terms of the telegraph,
yeah,
you could say that British people could outsource stuff to America, outsource production to America, import stuff and tell them what you need to manufacture by telegraph. But they don't really make that argument.
And it's more.
And nor do, because they say that wages went up in Britain, wages went up in America.
Yeah.
This idea that, you know, why would the internet? So by the way, I should note that they don't really give a convincing account of why most IT stuff is labor replacing. I don't think they're thinking about outsourcing. They do mention outsourcing and they say that the technology can encourage outsourcing, but I don't think that's their main story. I think that they mostly think of IT stuff as like, you know, Microsoft Excel and Word and email replace, you know, the old desk jobs of like the 1970s where people were like moving pieces of physical paper from an inbox to an outbox.
Yes. Now, which is the Mott and which is the Bailey? Whatever it is.
The Bailey is the crazy one. The Mott is the somewhat reasonable one.
All right. So the Mott is the tower and the Bailey is the entire enclosure.
Yes.
All right. Can I retreat to the Mott? That
retreat to the Mott.
Large oligopolistic tech firm. With mammoth market power, mammoth market share, and a more than $1 trillion market valuation, is highly likely to be producing at large scale and facing a downward sloping demand curve. And such a company is highly likely to see its profits go up by technologies that substitute for rather than complement its high placed labor. And that de-skill and degrade workers wherever possible, simply because you face a downward sloping demand curve and the profits you are going to get for this innovation are going to come from your ability to either reduce your costs and expand your market, and you can't expand your market very far because you already have a very large and noticeable share of the whole thing. As opposed to technologies established either by non-profit bureaucracies or by crazed individuals who've seen too many Tony Stark movies and who genuinely want to create change the world rather than just make lots of money. That nonprofit bureaucracies funding blue sky stuff, i.e. DARPA, and crazed individuals who think the game is changing the world rather than earning a return for shareholders are likely to have a much bigger sense of what kinds of technologies we would explore than people who work for flint-eyed accountants who say, how could this possibly help our bottom line?
Mm-hmm. My approach to economic history is basically argument from authority. And the authority is usually Brad DeLong.
Well,
and
thank you. Okay. So you're going to
occasionally,
be in a rather difficult
Occasionally
position.
It is Leah Boustan, Mark Koyama, Pseudo Erasmus, or one of the other sort of econ history crew.
Yes.
But usually it's Brad DeLong. And so, their classic example of a technology that replaced human labor is not actually the internet. It is, although that is that they have a whole chapter on that, but their classic example is looms. And so I wanted to call this, you know, book like the Bible of the Luddites, because one of the central arguments is that the original Luddites were absolutely right to smash the looms. And, although maybe smashing was actually the wrong tactic, but it would have been good if the looms had never been created.
Better if looms had never been created.
And so the looms were a mistake. Power looms were a mistake. Is the idea of is a central contention of this book. So the original
Luddites
were
right. So they came in more slowly.
Maybe they did not discuss that.
I suppose, first of all, you say the Luddites were active primarily between 1811 and 1816, which is kind of before there were many automatic looms. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So there's a problem there.
Yes.
What did the Luddites break, actually?
It was knitting frames.
I'm up on. What?
It was framed, knitting frames. It's like a proto loom. It's like a thing that you hang stuff to weave it.
Right.
And it
stocking
shuttles
frames.
It back and forth.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. It goes like
stocking
this, right?
Stocking frames. Mm-hmm.
The robot is basically just this motion, if I recall. Uh-huh. I've seen a video.
Right. Right, right.
I'm
right.
not educated, but I've seen a YouTube video. Anyways, the idea is that this impoverished British workers, and they don't really offer empirical support for this. They offer empirical support for the idea that a few highly specialized British people in the textile occupation, the canonical, like, you know, master weavers.
Yes.
Right. Those people had their human capital valued, but they don't offer evidence that I can find that British people were that the British workers were immiserated. They do.
Andrew Carnegie's father, who was a weaver in his cottage, was immiserated. So they packed up and moved to America, where Andrew Carnegie then became the third richest person in the world. Yeah, there's cotton, which is the only fiber you can actually use in early textile machinery without breaking too much to make it worthwhile. There's spinning that was automated early, and there was weaving, that was automated late. And, the key thing for the classic industrial revolution is the automation of spinning, which creates an enormous demand for cotton on the one hand, and an enormous demand for people to weave the yarn and thread into cloth on the other, so it then can be exported so that Britain can afford to import food, because Britain has become a major food deficit country. So the invention of knitting was somewhat of a disemployment effect on home knitting production and on the wages, and mostly people who were knitting who were kind of spinning yarn could then go and do other things, and the automation of spinning was a huge boom for people working in weaving, and gave weaving a 50-year golden age, and was also a huge boom to the marginal product of people who were growing and picking cotton. Unfortunately, given who was doing the growing and the picking of cotton, it was a substantial negative for them as well, because all of a sudden they became so valuable that even though George Washington freed all of his slaves on death, and Thomas Jefferson ought to free all of his slaves at death, after them, with the coming of the cotton gin and the serious British Industrial Revolution, no one really wanted to free their slaves in the American South. And so you go from George Washington in 1795 being confident that the Virginia legislature will free its slaves within a generation to Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee actually refusing to free his father-in-law's slaves after his death, even though it's in accordance with the will, because he wants to pile up more money in the estate before he settles it as executor. So the entire Industrial Revolution complex is first a golden age for weavers, and then a anti-golden age for cotton-growing slaves, and then comes the crash when the hand loom gets replaced by the power loom, and when the very industry that has grown enormously in the previous generation because of technological innovation, where people get hammered to a remarkable extent.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that I looked for evidence about this, and I saw that, I found some evidence, some people saying, okay, well, wages didn't really go down during this time. Like, wages grew more slowly, but that they did not, there was no big productivity wage divergence, right? So wages grew slowly, and productivity during the age of the loom, the early industrial revolutionary age, basically the 1700s, mid-1700s.
The power loom tends to come in around 1830 or so.
The power loom is 1830. Okay, but this is talking about the 1700s, like 1750 through 1800, basically, late 1700.
Yeah, I mean, spinning gets automated then, but you can't really see its impact in rural households where women and such had previously been spending a lot of time spinning. You really can't see the impact anywhere in the economy. You can see the impact in some rural districts where when the power loom comes in, a bunch of rural outmigration and a bunch of parliamentary reports and other things saying there's genuinely rural distress because there isn't enough agricultural work in these districts to support everyone, especially in the winter. And people were genuinely relying on their weaving earnings, which had been boosted by the fact that they were weaving machine-spun yarn, which was now very, very cheap. That is causing significant, you know, absolutely significant distress. At which point, economist Nassau Sr. Comes in and says, no, you shouldn't provide any income support to people who had been handling weavers, because what they need to do is they need to leave. They need to leave the industry. They need to leave the district. And, you know, if you let them stay in the district by actually allowing them not to starve to death, well, then you'll just have to keep feeding them. And in the long run, you still need the same amount of distress to get them to move out. And by postponing that distress, all you're doing is you're spending public money for no purpose. Nassau Sr. Right. being a rather grim kind of guy.
I have a question, Brad.
Yeah?
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Did the age, did either the spinning automation age or the weaving automation age or both, did either of these lead to mass impoverishment or stagnation in living standards for ordinary British people across the board? Not like, you know, forget about focusing on the people who were doing weaving before the power looms came along.
Right.
Forget about the people who were doing spinning before the spinning machines came along. I'm talking about the average, you know, like, you know, British working class person or middle class person or whatever, like the average, the typical Briton in, you know, after the invention of those technologies, did they actually either get poorer or experience a stagnation in the growth of their living standards just contemporaneously with those technologies? Did that happen?
There is a stagnation, the thing that Robert Allen calls Engels's pause, you know, after Friedrich Engels. And it was kind of the thing that Friedrich Engels was seeing as he was wandering around, you know, Manchester in his capacity as a textile, you know, baron in the early 1840s.
And what years were that? Was Engels paused?
Various, right? Say 1815 to 1855, you know, that just when Karl Marx starts to work seriously on capital, the pause ends. Some of it is simply the business cycle wasn't something that society had. The industrial business cycle was something new, and society had no way to cope with cyclical unemployment.
Rather more of it
was that, you know, the demographic transition has not yet begun, and England is a food deficit place, and yet it's having a high rate of population increase, plus there's a lot of immigration from Ireland. And so it's Engels's pause has always seemed to me much more likely to be the last gasp of the Malthusian economy rather than a huge episode of technological disemployment and of capital substituting for labor rather than complementing it.
Got it. Okay. So,
you know, but just because capital has always complemented labor in the past, if it has, doesn't mean it's going to complement labor in the future. Because in the past, you know, as you say, in the past, every single machine has needed a microcontroller, and human brains are pretty good microcontrollers, better than alternatives. You know, the fear is that the next newest wave of technologies is actually going to be good enough microcontrollers and good enough software bots to actually push a lot of things that people have been used to doing out of the human, you know. What's going to be done to people is about what was done to the horse by the Model T starting in the 1910s.
Right. Okay. So we'll talk about AI a bit.
There are a lot of people doing this, right? That just this morning I was reading the awesomely smart, you know, Ken Rogoff saying that AI is likely to disrupt and destroy tens of millions of jobs. And I really don't know who he's been talking to, because he's not on this coast. I can understand why he might say that if he were on this coast and had by an accident gone to the wrong venture capital pitch. But the fact that people in Cambridge, Massachusetts are thinking this is a sign.
I have to just restrain myself from making an Excel joke here.
What's the okay? All right.
All right,
It wasn't the
so
Excel. The Excel spreadsheet error was minor, right? The major error was simply having one residual category for above 90% debt to GDP ratio, throwing Japan in as one of your sample countries, and then taking the mean effect in that particular bin and
I
saying
know.
that starts at 90%.
I'm going to break our rule that we should stop talking about things that the audience just has no idea what we're talking about.
Okay.
And I'm going to say let's actually get back to the topic.
All right.
Normally we wouldn't do this, but this is an emergence. We're
Okay.
actually going to all right.
All
So
right. Now, can I also say that, well, I think the problem is that the best examples for Acemoglu and Johnson are actually outside of the economic.
Explain.
That the Roman Empire, right? You want to see a vicious circle by which technology, broadly construed, and society enable a bad outcome. By which technology and society enable domination, which then shapes technology and society, make them more friendly to further domination. Look at the expansion of the Roman Empire, from Rome being just kind of a valley town in minus 350 to something that rules the entire Mediterranean basin, by the year 150. That in the Roman Empire, kind of what we would regard as normal technological progress in technologies of production, it was pretty much limited to aqueducts and to construction and to road building and kind of covered marketplace building and ways to expand scale and maybe some routinization of pottery production to take advantage of the Roman peace. But there was really immense progress in technologies of military road building, of siege weapons, of administration and taxation, of tax farming, of figuring out how to actually organize a legion so that it had units rather than just being a single mob trying to move in the right direction, which enabled originally a relatively small city-state in the valley in a not too big plain in Italy to wind up conquering and ruling the entire Mediterranean basin and keeping going until, right, that the last person to call himself a Caesar only handed down the crown in only handed away his crown in 1947. That's you can say the Roman Empire, once it had conquered you and you had an opportunity to win your freedom by becoming a freedman rather than just a slave, it was pretty good because there were baths and so forth, and there was general peace. But the very process of expansion was everything you can say about the bad side of technological progress and more, if you think technological progress includes, how to organize things so that Julius Caesar can use 50,000 Roman soldiers to kill 1 million Gauls and enslave another million.
Well, I think we should definitely do an episode on why the Roman Empire sucked, and we should get that guy who, what's that book that said the Roman Empire was responsible for, like, centuries of technological stagnation in Europe, and Europe basically falling behind,
Was this Walter
Asia and the Middle
Scheidel?
East.
Was this Walter Scheidel at
Oh,
Stanford?
Walter Scheidel, is he around? Is he alive?
Yes, he's very much alive. He teaches at Stanford.
Cool.
You can he might
Nice. He's right here. Let's
can
get
go
him.
down to Los Altos and be very near to him this afternoon, this evening.
Let's do it.
You
Let's
know.
get Scheidel.
Although maybe if we are going to go to Roman history, in addition to Scheidel, I would like to get this guy Brett Devereux, who is
Yeah,
hanging out in Carolina and needs a tenure track job,
all right.
for which he is eminently capable of handling, and which
I
people should
love
have hired
Brett.
him long before now.
I wrote an incredibly well-read blog post where I just sort of made fun of him, and then he
Listen.
wrote an incredibly well-read blog post where he made fun of me back.
Okay.
And
What
so
did
we
he make
definitely
fun
need to
of
get him
you?
as a
What did he make
guest.
fun of you for?
I made fun of him for saying that, like, everything is just like Rome, and then he made fun of me for, like, basically being an idiot. I don't know, but
No, you kind of look at the White House and you look at the Capitol building, you can kind of see.
okay. All right, well, that's neither here nor there right now. So let's talk about Acemoglu and Johnson. Acemoglu and Johnson believe that entrepreneurs have a choice. They select from a menu of technologies. They can say, we can invent something to replace people, or can we, or we can choose to invent something that gives people more tasks to do, like that complements people's labor in the sense that it gives people more types of stuff to do. So we've always, entrepreneurs are always facing this choice, and often they'll choose the wrong thing. And not only will they choose the wrong thing, but they will use their quote unquote power, which to them means persuading people and writing articles and, you know, tech bro-y kind of PR, but they'll use their mighty power of blog post writing and tweeting to, you know, to convince the world to allow them to invent the human replacing thing so that they can make a couple more bucks than they would if they invented the human complementing thing, at least in the short run. And this is their thesis. This is what they're arguing. And it makes no sense to me. I'm like, what are you guys even talking about?
Well, Steve Jobs would agree with them. Steve Jobs would say a personal computer is a bicycle for the mind that empowers individuals, while the mainframe is a vehicle of social control by a large corporation that wants to de-skill you, and that Microsoft is an agent of hell because it is trying to take the microcomputer and trying to turn the microcomputer into an adjunct of the mainframe and of the network. And so you should buy Apples rather than Windows machines, or else, you know, that kind of Steve Jobs saying the Macintosh is the reason that 1984 is not going to be like 1984 at the 1984 Super Bowl commercial. That's an argument that there is a menu of potential choices out there. But where I think you're right is that we have absolutely no idea of what those choices really are.
Right, because when you talk about Steve Jobs, Jobs believes that he explicitly believes he's creating a human complementing technology that will create a whole bunch of new types of things for people to do. And anecdotally, looking at what the PC has done, I would agree with him. I would say that the things that people spend their days doing now are vastly, vastly different than the thing people spent their days doing in 1982 or whatever. Yes. Just think
if you had to write Noah Opinion on a typewriter, right?
How would I disseminate it?
You had to put sticky, sticky white things on it to cover up your typos when you typed over them. Or even worse,
I didn't have to live to see that dystopia. You had to suffer through it. That's basically like living through the Cultural Revolution. And I feel bad for you.
You don't even know what a Ditto machine is, do you?
No.
You've never seen one.
That's a fan of Rush Limbaugh, right?
No. A Ditto machine is simply you write on it, and then you put it on a cylinder, and you turn the crank, and, you know, it's a way you can make about 50 cheap copies of something through this yucky smelling fluid.
Wait, is this for like grinding like you know, seeds up into like meal?
No. This is for making, say, 50 copies of a handout for your entire elementary school grade.
I see.
You usually type one original on the Master, and you feed it through the machine, and there's this yucky fluid that is the ink. It's a very low quality, very cheap printing press. Yeah.
Got it. Question is,
and you never have heard of
fire when you're a kid. Like, what did you do?
What? I actually did make fire with a flint once. I never managed to make fire with a bow. I went to make fire with a flint once.
Were you in Boy Scouts?
Cub Scouts.
Cub Scouts, got it. I attempted to make fire with a flint and got many sparks, but before I could finish it, someone else just grabbed the flint and did it instead.
Okay.
But anyway, that was the extent of my flint fire making, and I think I'd probably just die in the wild. But Steve Jobs didn't, you know, even if Asimov and Johnson are right that the information technology revolution was massively human substituting instead of human complementing, which I doubt, which I think that they're probably wrong about that. But even if they were right, completely right about that, it's simply not true that Steve Jobs knew that ahead of time. It's simply not true that the people who created this knew that they were, you know, had any idea of whether or not what they were creating would substitute or complement human labor more. They thought it would create new tasks. And honestly, I think they were probably right, but whether or not they were right, they thought they were right. Mm-hmm. And that's the important part, because if we think that entrepreneurs now have an idea of this menu have an accurate idea of a menu of technologies available to them, you know, which ones will complement humans, which ones will replace them. If we think like, if we think entrepreneurs know that in advance, that's just utter hubris, because they don't, we don't, mm-hmm. nobody knows ahead of time. That's how I see things. And yet they insist that entrepreneurs have a choice ahead of time, which kind of, whether to invent labor complementing or labor substituting technologies. And it makes mm-hmm. no sense to me.
So this is the deal with the problems we have rather than the problems we are not sure will ever come to be. Yeah, a theory.
What do you mean?
No, simply that we have enough problems now. And to worry that our technological development is kind of on the wrong track because maybe it will produce technologies that are labor substituting rather than labor complementing in the future, when we have no good way of estimating even in partial equilibrium, let alone in general equilibrium, what the long run effects of these technologies on the menus of tasks that's valuable for people to do and thus what people do. That's a diversion of effort that we really cannot find or cannot afford. And right. if we actually delay technological progress out of a fear of it, you know, we are passing up opportunities to increase our human wealth, power, and flourishing that are very hard to get any other way. And we're also believing that the future is unable to deal with its problems. You know, we're depriving them of opportunities to turn things to good that they might well be able to turn to good, simply on the grounds that we know better than they what the consequences of these technologies will be, when actually we do not know them at all. When actually, if we did know them, we would have managed to have developed them already.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is my assessment as well. And I don't see a single shred of evidence presented in this book. After combing through it, I don't see a single shred of evidence that entrepreneurs and technologists have any foreknowledge at all of the effects on the labor market of the technologies that they invent.
Well, but we can say that an awful lot of jobs, even good jobs, in the recent past have fallen into three categories. One is being robots we don't yet know how to build. A second is being microcontrollers for machines. And a third is being software bots for routine paper flow tasks. And that all three of those now may well be under threat from the next generation or two of information technologies, which would tend to leave humans only with kind of personal care and emotional support jobs, that and genuine creative thought and presumably wholesale and wholesale delivery would be the things that were left. And so there is perhaps more reason now than
I would argue
before.
That even the I would argue that there, you know, mm-hmm. even, you know, sort of generalities such as like microcontrollers, blah blah blah, it's very difficult to yes. operationalize that. And I'll give two yes. examples here.
Yes.
The first example is radiology.
Yes.
Now, Geoffrey Hinton, who invented the transformer and is possibly the most influential AI scientist to have ever lived, and mm-hmm. is an absolutely brilliant person who regularly destroys critics, you know, in debates. He said that radiology will be gone. I don't remember the exact prediction. It was like within a couple of years, he right. said there will be no more human radiologists. So mm-hmm. it's done.
Yes.
He definite prediction, do not go into radiology. Yes. Now, of course, no one listened to him because no one's paying attention to an AI guy when deciding what career to go into. But mm-hmm. fast forward to a year after his prediction was supposed to come true, and yes. there have never been more human radiologists than now.
Right.
And they and there's a shortage. Wages are great. Yes. And there's a shortage. Everyone's scrambling to try to get human radiologists.
Because now
this
we
does
actually
not mean
have...
that AI was not developed.
So now we actually have the ability yes. to use AI to sharpen our images. And so as a result, we can actually see things. And so every single doctor now wants to order many, many mega scans so that they can actually see what's going on inside rather than guessing and saying, take two yes. aspirin. Okay. Now,
right, resulting in massive employment for radiologists.
Can I counterpose two people yeah. and ask you which one you agree with more?
No, and because I want to give example number two first, and then
example
we'll
number two. All right.
Example number two is trucking.
Yes.
Francis Wilkerson.
Yes.
The politics writer for Bloomberg. Great guy.
Yep.
He's a friend.
Yep.
Love dude. He had, I think, worked as a trucker briefly, and he insisted to me, we were walking through the mothership building at Bloomberg, and he just insisted very strongly that in just a few years there would be no more human truckers. Just will not happen. There is now a trucking shortage.
This was long haul.
There's now a shortage of truckers. Well, he made an argument for both, but there's a shortage of both.
I might argue that
we should
have many fewer long haul truckers than we do now. And the reason we failed is that we haven't taken enough chunks of our interstate and made them automated truck only lanes. That we don't have enough dedicated lanes for truck trains going on, and we could substitute for a lot
Maybe not
by doing that,
but okay so I guess the point is that this was a failed
prediction was wrong. Prediction was fundamentally
the prediction
wrong.
Was wrong, and Francis Wilkerson is not Darren Acemoglu, but he's a smart guy who pays attention to a specific industry,
right?
And he's not Jeffrey Hinton either. I would say a third example is Acemoglu and Restrepo's work on robots, which was then countermanded by like a dozen other papers in short order and was wrong, but which he still seems to believe that that is right and that none of the follow-up papers happened or mattered in his book. He believes that he wrote the paper on this and that settled it and that no one else wrote anything. In his book, he treats it as if it's a fact that robots reduced hiring when everyone else found the exact opposite. And it's just, so there's a graveyard of these predictions.
Right.
By experts in industry, by experts in economics, and by smart lay people. There's a graveyard of predictions of whether technologies will substitute human labor.
All right. At any rate. Now, I had two people for you to decide which one you agreed with. And the first person is the one who writes, how do we know in advance, before a technology is invented, whether it will increase or decrease the labor share? Fundamentally, it boils down to some sort of mandarins trying to assess the economic effects of a technology that doesn't even exist yet. This is probably an impossible task. Inferior to policies to increase labor share ex post, like co-determination, sectoral bargaining, and wage substitute is funded by taxes on capital income. That's person one.
Subsidies, but yeah.
Yeah. Person two is identifying the actual distributional effects of a technology's deployment is extremely challenging, and that formulating interventions to move deployment toward machine-useful applications is even more so. Carrots rather than sticks, antitrust, an active government role in supporting innovative technologies, government as the first collaborative consumer, academia's central role in the cultivation and exercise of social power, changing the narrative, and with it, cultural norms, building countervailing power, and generating relevant policy solutions.
And that is Simon Johnson?
No.
Who's that?
That's Bill Janeway.
Oh, Bill Janeway. Okay.
But Bill Janeway says he generally agrees with Johnson and Robert Johnson and Acemoglu. You, by contrast, call for Acemoglu and Johnson to have written a very interesting books about how technologies that complement humans are better for both productivity and broad-based prosperity than technologies that try to substitute for humans wholesale.
Well, yes.
Yes.
Correct. I believe that Janeway, my guess is that he did not read the book in detail.
Ah, okay.
I read the book in excruciating detail, and I think that he, they say,
yes,
okay. Acemoglu and Johnson say nice things about unions.
Yes,
in the book, because Johnson likes unions.
Yes,
I like unions too. Bill Janeway likes unions too.
Yes,
we don't always like unions, but we like the idea of unions at least. Mm-hmm. And so, so Acemoglu and Johnson, say that they want unions to do stuff, and they give examples of unions nudging companies to invent the right kind of technologies. And 100% of these examples are examples where unions pushed companies to invest in worker training so that workers could use the new technologies that were being invented anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So basically, unions as you know, an incentive for companies to invest in human capital, which could be an externality. And so that's so I think that if when you look at Acemoglu's paper, for example, Acemoglu wrote this paper claiming with Restrepo, published in 2022, I think in Econometrica, claiming that 80% or more than 80% of the run-up in inequality has been caused by labor substituting technologies. They claim that 0% has been caused by deunionization. So Acemoglu's research that is underpinning this book claims that unions do nothing with regards to inequality, nothing at all. Now, as I said, I have big problems with the methodology of this paper. But essentially, the brief nice things that Acemoglu and Johnson said about unions were said entirely for political marketing purposes, because actually the research that Acemoglu is basing his arguments on says that unions are irrelevant.
So your view is that,
and I wonder if Bill Janeway read that.
That Janeway and I are seeing an Acemoglu and Johnson, which is much more favorable to our view of carrots rather than sticks and of cleaning up after the fact than the book they actually wrote. Which is very much alarmist. Correct. We need to slow down all these technologies until we can figure out what's going on. That we need to pause the ability of tech oligarchs and of the Magnificent Seven to actually develop technologies because they are sure to try to develop them in the wrong direction.
Correct.
Okay.
And as an additional datum, I will say that I was at a supply side progressivism conference. It's under Chatham House rules, so I can't tell you who it was except privately. But I can't tell you who it was who said this. But there were two people there who claimed very loudly that we need councils, including academics from the humanities, to pre-approve research efforts into technologies based on whether or not they will replace human labor. And although this conference was, you know, this conference was organized by, you know, Ezra Klein and some other friends of ours, and almost the entire conference was just complaining about NIMBYs making it harder to build things. And then someone comes out and says, "No, well, you know, we need before we make any invention, we need to we need to pass it through this committee of humanities academics to decide whether it's going to replace people." And that was the most disastrously dumb idea that I've ever heard. That I'm just like, even Europe isn't dumb enough to do that.
I would say neo-fascism is a worse idea. I would say mandatory neo-fascism and immigration to the United States is a worse idea, but I get your point.
Correct. That is an even worse idea. But the fact that we had to actually think for a second to think of a worse idea is telling, because that's a terrible idea. And I think that...
Yes. And that's where they're headed.
You know, Acemoglu and Johnson, I think... Yes, they're very much they're headed toward there. And in fact, so they say that right now we don't think we need robot taxes, but in the future we may. And right now, all we need is a council to like determine which sort of new technologies to promote, right? Which sort of new things we'll promote that we think will be labor complementing. And I think, well, you know what? Promoting to like if you add government money to new things, if you say, okay, guys, we need to increase subsidies for technology as long as we increase the subsidies and direct them toward things that will complement humans, fine, go ahead. You don't know what they are, and it's going to be extremely wasteful compared to, you know, other purposes like fighting climate change or defeating China. But, you know, like, but
feeding
it's
China,
it's
managing
the idea
China.
Of gatekeeping.
Managing China, assisting China in its future demographic transition. Helping China get out of its current middle income trap and back to a pro-market, pro-investment, pro-freedom economic growth path. We don't fight China, we help China. But I can't let this end.
Well,
I can't let
yourself.
You head off. I can't let you head off on your trip down to Los Altos this afternoon without giving you a chance to rant about whether persuasion is a form of power or not.
Is persuasion a form of power? Well,
that tech bro
if persuasion is a form
Acemoglu,
of power.
Acemoglu and Johnson, joined by Henry Farrell, say that tech bros having very large megaphones is a bad thing.
Right.
And as a source of them,
anyway.
exerting power over other people in a profoundly illegitimate way.
Yes.
And now it's unclear
That is
whether they
silly.
mean that tech bros' exercise of free speech rights are illegitimate, or whether they want to draw some distinction between free speech and free reach, and to say tech bros should be allowed to speak, but only in small soundproof booths where no one can hear them, or what is going on. But I do remember the idea that
Okay, so
participating in a public debate can be, or can be illegitimate in a sense that one applies the P for power word to it and regards it as a bad thing, is, I think you think, a very, very dangerous road to go down.
yes,
Yes.
absolutely. The
Yes.
idea of, the idea that simply making arguments that happen to resonate with people in an unrestricted, marketplace of ideas,
Yes.
freedom of the press and speech and all those things,
Yes.
the idea that that
Yeah.
is a form of coercive power,
Yes.
it makes the concept of power useless and also even counterproductive. Like the idea that people just hearing arguments and deciding those arguments are right means
Yep.
power has been exercised. The only way you get there is
Okay.
by just assuming that all outcomes are due to power and then you applying the
Right.
label power to whatever you think produce the outcomes. In other words, it's very similar to the definition of technology used by Ed
Yeah.
Prescott, which is basically like, we have a residual. I will label the residual technology.
And then we
No.
believe it is. Yes.
Like,
Yeah.
or, right. And other people will label the residual culture, right?
Yeah.
It's the
Yeah.
magic secret sauce. It's the
Yeah.
phlogiston, which I refuse to pronounce it phlogiston because phlogiston sounds so much awesomer to say.
Which
But
one is it
anyway,
really? Do we know?
it's phlogiston, unfortunately. It's
How do we know?
I don't remember. A bunch of people like
Okay.
got on me about this and corrected me,
All
and I think
right. All right.
Pseudo-Erasmus
All
said
right.
it. And oh no,
Okay. Now,
screw all you people. It's pronounced Werner Vinge and it's pronounced phlogiston.
Okay. Gilgamesh, King of Earth,
Anyway.
says if you don't work for
Yes.
10 hours a day building this wall around the city that I think would look pretty, and then afterwards, exhausted, go home and send your wife to spend the night with me. If you don't do that, I will stab you with this spear. And because I'm a trained warrior and got protein in utero, I'm 6 inches taller than you. You will die. That's an exercise of power, right? Right?
That's
Because that's,
power, yeah.
yeah. Now,
Yes.
Gilgamesh
That's power. That's real
getting the
power.
priestess of Inanna to say Gilgamesh is favored of the gods. He is two-thirds god and one-third man himself. You must obey him because obeying him is pleasing to the gods. Is that an exercise of power?
No.
No.
Well, it depends on
No.
so I actually don't know because I actually don't know. I actually
Yeah.
don't know what kind of power the priestesses had. Like, I don't know what they were able to do.
They could tell you that the first new moon after the sun rose just to the north of this mountain peak was the time to plant. And they also could
Right.
tell you that the
There
first
may have
new
been,
moon
the
after the
answer is I don't know
sun.
if that was power because I don't know the institutions of the Gilgamesh age. I don't know what the institutions were, so I can't tell you off the top of my head. It's possible the priestess had real power. It's possible the priestess was just some jerk that occasionally people listened to and occasionally they didn't. I don't understand the institutional structure of this question. I
But
do understand
you would agree that verbal frauds, that verbal, that there's a form of verbal fraud that becomes more or less the equivalent of power, that can be carried
No.
out by people.
No, definitely
No,
not.
no, 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 no.
No, bullshit is not power.
Okay.
Saying bullshit that people happen to believe is not power. That is a way to get things done, but calling it power, because why didn't someone else bullshit that way? Like, if you have it assumes that that
So
people
where it
have
is
mind
when Gilgamesh, so
control
when
powers.
Gilgamesh stabs, when Gilgamesh stabs the priest who says Gilgamesh is not beloved of the gods, Gilgamesh is actually the hated of the gods and is in fact the descendant of a devil. That it's when Gilgamesh stabs that priest that the priestly megaphone then becomes an instrument of power. When you manage to successfully use real force to outlaw other points of view from the public square. And otherwise, we want to go all in on John Stuart Mill.
Right. I say that if you have, you know, to the degree that when you restrict some people's speech, then that's the application of power. Mm. But the idea that some people, so why are the tech bros so persuasive? When you ask Acemoglu and Johnson, what they say is luck. They say, actually, they just had a message that happened to resonate. They literally say this. They literally say this. Let me find the passage.
They also had some
I have to scroll through my own.
They also had some awfully
they
big
said,
megaphones.
They said the authors don't venture to say exactly why these techno-optimists pro-business vision prevailed. They write that, quote unquote, an idea is more likely to spread if it is simple, is backed by a nice story, and has a ring of truth to it. But they admit that quite a bit of the process of persuasion is random, and declare that you are enormously lucky if you get the right idea, just the right ring to it at just the right time. In other words, so I wrote, in response to this, I wrote, I do not understand why we should put accidental success in a nonviolent marketplace of ideas in the same conceptual category as chattel slavery and feudalism.
That was a good line.
It seems to yield neither understanding nor solutions.
That was a good
line. I do not understand why we should put those in the same category. Mm-hmm. That is foolish.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
And there also is a kind of
why should we think?
Yeah, there's also a distortion of the Silicon Valley ideology, which has great and very large amounts of human liberation through technology, autonomy, and knowledge, as well as let's get some people to buy some crypto assets for one more rug pull associated with it. Right.
Right. So deception is deception.
All right. And power
is power.
I see
no
power.
Reason to call it power. I see no reason
bullshit
to call deception
bullshit.
Power.
Power is power. Bullshit is bullshit. Deception is deception. A plausible silver-tongued person committing fraud is a very different animal, especially as it's very difficult to commit a 100% fraud because at some level you really have to believe it yourself if you're going to be successful in the long run. You know, and Rush Limbaugh started out with zero. Rush Limbaugh did not start out with a big megaphone.
Right.
Rush Limbaugh started out with an audience and the sense of aggrievement and ability to pay to it. And to say that the people were fooled by Rush Limbaugh is not right. It is that Rush Limbaugh gave form and shape to things that were inside of them. All right. Okay, so
to quote
I guess
the great DJ
my,
Khaled, congratulations, you played yourself.
Yes.
Anyway.
So I guess
all
my...
All right, so we got to wrap up. I have to leave right now,
yeah,
so...
Yeah. I guess my key insight is that Acemoglu and Johnson should have written their very interesting book about how technologies that complement humans are better for both productivity and broad-based prosperity than technologies that try to substitute for humans wholesale. And they should have dipped their toe into saying that the incentives of large oligarchical tech companies with multi-trillion dollar valuations are plausibly not aligned with our interests in the sense of trying to figure out how to spur the development of technologies that complement humans, and that they should have stopped there.
I agree. And stopping there could have still allowed for an 800-page book, because the idea that technologies that complement humans are the technologies that win, and what are the good technologies of history and the world, that would have been a book easily worth 800 pages that it was within their ambit to write.
And also, what are the bad technologies?
You know, I think
that I would like more examples of bad technologies besides the cotton gin and the Roman Empire.
Right.
Yes.
I do not want to have to go back to the Roman Empire for examples of bad. But
well, how about just the cotton
gin? I mean,
gin?
They did talk about the internet.
Yeah, just the cotton gin.
Yes, the idea that the internet was this bad technology that we could have known was going to just replace humans instead of complement them, that's Leave that in the editing and the cutting room floor. Leave that on the,
And, you know, you could have done a very good meditation on to what degree was the printing press worth 2 centuries of near genocidal religious war in Europe. You know, which it played a role, certainly a role in spurring. On the other hand, you got the printing press, albeit without musical type in China, and it produced a flowering of Buddhism and Taoism in lots of ways, but did not produce anything like, you know, my ancestors shooting out the windows of Canterbury Cathedral, stained glass windows of Canterbury Cathedral for target practice.
Right.
Okay. So what's
I
your
guess my key insight for this thing is, well, my key insight is that when there's a, among the intellectual circles we run in, there's a lot of people who are basically progressive, who are suspicious of the rich guys who are in charge of tech companies, who are pro-union, who are, you know, have deep concern for workers, who are generally pro-government, or at least, you know, in the ideal
not
sense.
Not anti-government.
Case.
Not reflexively anti-government.
Right, not anti-government. And who, for whom all those people, the blurb version of the Acemoglu and Johnson book seems to generally comport with and align with that political and intellectual persuasion of, you know, pro-labor, suspicious of billionaires, you know, intellectuals who still value technology and progress, but want, you know, think that there's some issues here that need to be managed. The Tim O'Reilly Foucamp sphere that we are both in. And I think that it was easy to look at this book and to just read the blurb and to, you know, or even to read like a little bit of the introduction. And it, as long as you skip the part where they said that the Haber-Bosch process that feeds like some huge percent of the human race is bad because it also led to some ineffectual chemical weapons in World War One. If you skip that part, it was possible to just get this overall idea of like, well, maybe billionaire tech, you know, founders don't always have the mass interests of people in mind. Okay, fine. But, you know, the specific thing that these guys have written just did not take. And I wanted to do this episode because you're literally the only person I've seen make a, you know, defense of this book. And so, like, I've been receiving Twitter DMs and emails saying I'm glad someone went after this book. I didn't want to because Acemoglu's so famous. And from people, from actual economists, you know, who study this stuff. And I'm like, well, someone, it's a dirty job, but someone has to do it. And that's why we have your friendly neighborhood economics blogger. And so anyway, that's my key insight, is that I spent way too much time on this book review.
All right. So why don't we add that everyone should go off and read Why Nations Fail instead.
Yes, let's do that. And all of Simon Johnson's other books, which are really excellent and underrated.
And our last key insight is?
As always, Hexapodia.
This has been Noah Smith's and Brad DeLong's Hexapodia podcast, in which Noah Smith certainly works out his psychological issues with respect to power and progress by Daron Acemoglu and Simon Johnson. Thank you very much for listening.
And goodbye.
Goodbye.